Well, ladies and gentlemen, just before we finally break the fire regulations, I don't think I've seen this hall quite so full. But it is, ladies and gentlemen, distinguished guests, a very great pleasure for me to welcome you to the school tonight on the occasion of the inaugural commemoration lecture of the Overseas Students Trust. I should explain that this is the first of the public lectures which will be given annually to commemorate the work of the Trust, an independent educational charity which goes back to 1961 and which has, over the past 30 years, led the way in improving conditions for overseas students in Britain, as well as reviewing and influencing the development of policies in the field of international education. We are only sorry that the chairman of the Trust for the last 12 years, Gordon Wilson, is not with us tonight. Sadly, he died last September. After the retirement of the Overseas Student Trust director, Martin Kenyon, in 1992, it was decided to bring the Trust's activities to an end. However, the Trust wished to find a successor body which would review developments in international education, assess their policy implications from an independent standpoint, and conduct research at the Trust's request. And at the Trust's request, the London School of Economics agreed to take on this role through our Centre for Educational Research. The theme agreed for the annual lecture is, to quote from one of the Trust's own publications, that the British experience must be seen in the wider context of the international mobility of students, which is one of the foundation stones of a peaceful, stable, and interdependent world. Well, we wanted to get the series off to a good start and have a lecturer and a lecture that matched, we felt, the importance of the occasion. We can think of no one better fitted to launch the series than our speaker tonight. Someone who is uniquely associated with the creation of a more tolerant, more peaceful and stable world, the Most Reverend Desmond Tutu, Archbishop of Cape Town. And it's a particular pleasure for us to welcome him here tonight, as he was, of course, a theology student at King's College just over the road from the school back in 1962. And it's interesting to reflect that the world of Christian faith and that of politics has similarly, in the Archbishop's life, never been very far apart. From an early age, influenced by such figures as Father Trevor Huddleston, he perceived an Africa disfigured by the apartheid system, and alongside his pastoral work as a priest, he maintained a vigorous and public commitment to social justice. It was while serving as Secretary of the South African Council of Churches from 1978 to 1985 that Bishop Tutu, as he then was, became a national and international figure. During the imprisonment of Nelson Mandela, Archbishop Tutu was seen as the responsible voice of the anti-apartheid movement, giving hope to millions of South African Christians. And in 1984, his work received the accolade of a Nobel Peace Prize. I was fascinated to read that Archbishop Tutu has described his student days in England, and at King's College in particular, as a whirlwind of fresh air, and that he found the atmosphere of London University exhilarating. Given our recent smogs, I think that's metaphorical rather than actual. But it seems to me that these descriptions could equally apply to the Archbishop himself. And judging from the packed theatre tonight, our audience have come with every expectation of an exhilarating experience. Well, any further words of mine will seem inadequate when talking about a man who has been described as having unmatched oratorical skills and of being a master of the brilliant phrase. One final word just before I introduce the Archbishop. He has said that time permitting, and we need to be out of this hall by about 20 to 8, But time permitting, he will take one or two questions. So without more ado, it's my very great pleasure then, ladies and gentlemen, to welcome Archbishop Desmond Tutu.
Director, ladies and gentlemen, I crave your indulgence because this is going to be largely autobiographical. And since I'm now somewhat decrepit, I'm sure you will humor me. Talking about being decrepit, I was visiting a village in the Netherlands, not recently, I might have drowned. And there was a school that was celebrating 400 years of existence, and for some odd reason, they had decided to rename the school after the Archbishop of Cape Town. And when I arrived at the school, one of the children came up to me and said, were you here when the school started? It is a very great joy and privilege to have been asked to deliver this inaugural lecture because it gives me the opportunity of expressing on my behalf, and I know it will also be on behalf of many others, a very warm tribute to the Overseas Students Trust for all the marvelous things it has accomplished since its founding in 1961. And first of all, as we have heard, seeking to improve the conditions of overseas students studying and living in the UK, and latterly for its very significant impact on government, education, and perhaps immigration policies, and for being such an effective and influential think tank in these and related areas. But it's even more wonderful because it enables me to express our deepest appreciation and gratitude to Martin Kenyon, who to all intents and purposes, and certainly as far as the Trust's clients were concerned, was the Trust incarnated. You could not have had a better advocate, representative, mentor, and friend for the students, often somewhat bewildered and homesick, than Martin, even if you had tried in a month of Sundays. What I will say relating to myself and to my family and how we evolved as persons and our subsequent involvements in developments in our home country and elsewhere might be applied mutandis to other persons and situations as might be thought to be appropriate. So here goes. One of the first things that happened to us, I'm going to have to be using, yes, words that we've already sort of taken, I'll take them out of your mouth, was the exhilarating experience of being regarded and treated as persons with an inalienable dignity that others acknowledged and respected. For many in this country, that was something taken as read, and you did not perform a song and dance about it. It was as obvious and as much a part of normal life as breathing. You noticed only if it stopped or there was something seriously wrong. You here took it so much for granted. But you see, we came from a country which had 2 years previously, in 1960, had the trauma of the Sharpeville massacre, which started a train of events that had, as their sequel, South Africa having to leave the Commonwealth or face the real prospect of being expelled for its vicious race policies. In that country, the nationalists, who had unexpectedly won the 1948 elections, in which only a minute fraction of the population participated, were quite determined to put the native in his place, and were engaging in an orgy of passing one piece of racist and repressive legislation after another. In the early days of apartheid's madness, they stampeded white voters into voting for them by showing a picture of an unkempt black and asking in somewhat conspiratorial tones, "Would you let your daughter marry this man?" Subsequently, they say blacks were to have their own back by asking, "Show us your daughter first." We were called natives with a capital N, but language was used in a kind of Alice in Wonderland disregard for its basic meaning. So you would have committed a horrible faux pas if you had asked a white South African lady, "Are you a native of these parts?" "Certainly not. I was born in this country and I'm a European." And then there was that peculiar phenomenon, blacks from outside South Africa who were called foreign natives. They used to have road signs reading, "Danger, natives, cross here." And some wag altered the sign to read somewhat hair-raisingly, "Danger, natives, very cross here." I discovered recently that one of those who used to go around changing the signs is now a close advisor to President Nelson Mandela, who Ahmed Cathedra, who was on Robben Island with him. When I told the story at one point, he said, "Well, actually, they used to go around. They were called the Paint Squad, I think." Subsequently, we were called plurals. I mean, you can't believe that. But I mean, I suppose one of us would be a singular plural. And if you were one who had come, say, from the countryside, a rural plural, we were also non-European. Somebody saying maybe we came from non-Europe. We lived in ghetto locations, characterized by squalor and deprivation. You are a nonentity, legislated for, discussed and talked about, having things done for you by those who invariably believed that they knew better than you what was good for you. I recall as a youngster going into stores with my father, who was a primary school headmaster, and hearing the slip of a girl behind the counter, because she was white, addressed my father as "boy." And I suffered for my father, for I was aware of the deep, demeaning humiliation that he was experiencing happening right in front of his child. There was something that happened regularly for many. As our fathers were hounded under the iniquitous past laws, which determined where you could live, where you worked, whether you could travel here or there, that you had no freedom of movement in the land of your birth. How could you have even this minimal right when you had no political clout of any significance? For it is political power, after all, that gives you access to other kinds of power. Your children received a segregated and discriminatory inferior education when the government, as you know, spent 10 times on one white child what it spent on a black child, children who often were suffering from malnutrition, kwashiorkor, and other perfectly easily preventable deficient diseases. You see, as a black, you did not vote because you could not vote in the land of your birth. And some of us waited 62 years to cast the vote for the first time in the land of our birth. Well, I came to England in 1962 and was warmly welcomed by Martin Kenyon and the Community of the Resurrection. Subsequently, we found wonderful, heartwarming hospitality at St. Albans Golders Green, opposite the Hippodrome. I want to say a big thank you to them all for their love and generosity over the 3 years we stayed there. I had not known just how apartheid had conditioned me until I went to a bank in Golders Green soon after we got there and joined that English institution, the queue. I was next to be served when a white man, quite clearly in a great hurry, rushed in, doing the unthinkable and perhaps unforgivable in England. He jumped the queue. And I was quite ready. Extraordinary. I was quite ready to give way to him when the lady teller told him, quite courteously but firmly, "He," meaning me, "is next to be served." Wow. You don't know what that did for me. I grew inches. I later told the teller that she had become my pinup. Quite extraordinary to discover that your self-esteem had been undermined to such an extent. And you see, the awfulness of racism is not just that it inflicts pain on its victims, as it almost certainly does. It's not just that it is evil, as it undoubtedly turns out to be. No, its ghastliness is that it can blasphemously make a child of God, any child of God, doubt that they're a child of God. And that seems to be almost the ultimate blasphemy, for it is a veritable spitting in the face of God. Because you see, my friend, racism has never been a benign phenomenon. It's not about discrimination with regard to the use of this or that facility. You see, it is racism that gave us the horrors of the slave trade. It is racism that gave us the horrors of the lynchings in the United States. It's racism that's given us the awfulness of the Holocaust and the ghastliness of apartheid. And you and I and all of us are constrained always to stand up against it wherever it rears its ugly head. Coming to the UK helped Leah and me to recover the dignity of our personhood. We discovered for the first time, as I said, what it meant to be persons whose dignity was acknowledged, whose dignity was respected. And it was a relief to arrive here and not have to pat your pockets each time you saw a police officer just wondering whether you've got your pass on you. And it was such a novel experience to have police who were your friends and unarmed at that. And we've related how in our first few days abroad, learned I would walk about even in the small hours, just to savor the, yes, exhilaration, of not having to observe a curfew. And it was we who often accosted police to ask for directions, as we've said before, even when we knew where we were going. Just to relish the experience of having a police officer and a white one to boot address us as sir, madam. It was mind-boggling for us. All these experiences were helping to exorcise from us the demons of self-hate and self-contempt, the inevitable concomitants of being victims of injustice and oppression. Martin helped us in this process by taking me to the Travelers Club. I'm something of a snob. And I learned to spit out the sort of gun pellets from the game fowl I had for lunch, as I learned to behave with decorum in that rarefied atmosphere. And I reveled in going with him to Lord's and was quite bowled over by just how many people of distinction Martin seemed to know. I'm sure he was not out to impress this third world bumpkin with suitable name dropping. He came to be a very, very real part of our family, with our children calling him Brother Martin, in deference to our African custom of not letting the young address older people by their first names. Our youngest then became Martin's godchild, and later was bridesmaid at his wedding, and I've sort of reciprocated. His younger daughter, Nina, is my godchild. Now, the rehabilitation of our humanity would prove indispensable to the extraordinary process of healing and reconciliation taking place in South Africa. And that has astounded the world so much. Because reconciliation, you see, is a deeply personal thing. You don't get reconciled to your dog. It was crucial, therefore, that we should have recovered our sense of personal worth for us to have been able to make some contribution to the process of change and nation building in South Africa. We used to attend the Harrington garden parties in Martin's flat, parties which only Martin could throw. The guests were a veritable United Nations or a Tower of Babel. Barriers were being broken, and relationships and friendships were being forged between people from different parts of the globe. Martin today is on first name terms with a glittering array of people who have gone back to play leading roles in their respective countries. Just as an example, he's on first name terms with Thabo Mbeki, our first deputy president. And that can't be without significance vis-a-vis the kind of influence he has been able to exercise and continues to do so even today. I know that someone like Abdul Minty, who was the secretary of the anti-apartheid campaign to monitor violations of the UN's arms embargo against South Africa, is fond of saying that many of those who became his friends in his university days went out to occupy important positions, making them privy to often sensitive, perhaps classified information, which they leaked to him, so that he was able to embarrass the South African government and other governments by exposing deals which they had not thought anyone outside a privileged circle would have known about. It will therefore be virtually impossible to assess the crucial role that Martin and the Overseas Students Trust might have played in ending the scourge of apartheid. Through his good service offices, we were able then, after 3 years in Golders Green, to go to Bletchingly, where we were overwhelmed with the love and caring of people there, the Lamberts and others, and one is just deeply, deeply grateful. I thumbed my very first lift in a Rolls Royce there. The second element, that was the first element, the second element in the impact that the UK has had on us happened at King's College London, referred to by the director, where I studied for 4 years. I had come out of a thoroughly authoritarian setting, not just politically, but perhaps more devastatingly in the philosophy that permeated our education. We were taught in South Africa that there was always the one right answer. And the purpose of education was teaching people not so much how to think as what to think. It was a highly valued attribute not to rock the boat, not to ask awkward questions, but to accept docilely what those in a position of authority pontificated about. You must always toe the line. It was thus not surprising that the authorities in South Africa could get away with some of the most outrageous and bizarre things, because we confused authoritarian with authoritative. It was to be expected, therefore, for most South Africans to think that if something was legal, that thing was necessarily morally right. And many got upset when, in our opposition to apartheid, we advocated breaking immoral laws, as happened with the 1989 defiance campaign led by the MASH Democratic Movement. They claimed that in breaking these laws, such as beach apartheid, we were engaging in a highly immoral enterprise. The extent of liberation I experienced when I got to King's is quite overwhelming. Here I was sitting at the feet of eminent scholars, household names, some of them, in their different disciplines. It was exhilarating to discover that they were so allergic to being dogmatic and doctrinaire. One of my Old Testament teachers, Professor Peter Aykroyd, exemplified, I think, this aversion to ramming one's view down the students' throats. He had a pet phrase which he used almost religiously at all his lectures. It is not unreasonable to suppose. Talking about some of these extraordinary expressions, I had a white South African friend, Brian Oosthuizen, and we used to sit together at lectures. And on one occasion, one of our professors was holding forth about this, that, or the other, and then said, and of course, the nigger in the woodpile. And Brian nudged me and said, that means you. It was so exciting to learn that there was often not just one answer. That life was complex, filled with ambivalences. That there were usually several viable options, and it was being left to you to decide which of these made most sense of the available evidence. Our teachers were more keen to develop in our minds that were wanting to ask awkward questions, but why? We may not always have learned this lesson as well as we should, for Africa and other parts might then have been spared the veritable rash of military dictatorships, coups, and totalitarian governments with their horrendous record of blatant human rights violations. We returned home, and I went to teach at something called the Federal Theological Seminary in Alice, in the Eastern Cape, and to be chaplain to the University of Forte, the flagship of African education for so long. You met people in other African countries who had been educated there, the Mugabes, who had been contemporaries with the Tambos, the Buthelezis, and the Mandelas. It had fallen on bad days when the nationalist government had ravaged it, making it part of the Bantu education charade. When it was taken over by Afrikaner ideologues, the students at Fort Hare painted graffiti reading, "Has Fort Hare gone to the dogs, or have the dogs come to Fort Hare?" We tried at the Federal Seminary to inculcate a style of education that set a premium on inquiring, skeptical minds. The difference between the ethos at the Federal Seminary and at Fort Hare was as stark as that between chalk and cheese. We're trying to reflect here what we had found so invigorating overseas. Fort Hare now is being rehabilitated. This is so to such an extent that it had Oliver Tambo as its chancellor, a Fort Hare ex-student who had been turfed out before he could get his degree. Since his death, he has been succeeded by Governor Mbeki, Thabo Mbeki's father and an ex-Robben Islander. The new Minister of Education in our government of national unity, Sibusiso Bengu, was the first rector of Fort Hare after the period of rehabilitation had begun. I have since become Chancellor of the University of the Western Cape, which aligned itself unequivocally with the people in the struggle against apartheid. It has become an exhilarating institution, a site of the struggle. In the bad old days, I would often be called in because the police had invaded our campus, and sometimes we'd be lobbing tear gas canisters into students' residences. We were certainly not at that time ivory towers. And the caliber of its faculty is demonstrated by the number of ex-UWC staff members in the new government or in parliament. Its former Vice-Chancellor, Jake Scherville, is now heading President Mandela's office as its Director General. The ministers of Justice, of Water Affairs and Labor are former UWC personnel. The leader of the Senate is also one such. For a relatively young institution, we have not done too badly. And we've been guided by an academic leadership which has been exposed to international influences in shaping the nature of this and other tertiary institutions. At King's, I was impressed by the idealism of the young British students I encountered there. They had a passion to make the world a better place, and they believed that it was, in fact, an improvable world. They were involved with things like War on Want, CND, Oxfam, and they were beginning to be part of the anti-apartheid movement. And we owe them a tremendous, tremendous debt of gratitude for their part in the sanctions campaign and the sports and cultural boycotts. These things have succeeded marvelously. We would not have notched up our spectacular victory over injustice and oppression without their considerable help. Our victory is their victory, is your victory. And one of the great privileges I have is being able to go around the world where I used to be saying, please help us, now to be going around and saying, your help has helped us to accomplish this incredible miracle, and to be able to say thank you. Thank you, thank you. Thank you for an incredible thing that you have done for us. Meeting up with these young people to whom I always doff my hat, it taught me that we should never feign impotence before even a massive problem, that each one of us can make a difference. For this is a moral universe. Right and wrong do matter. Our choice in favor of truth and goodness, our individual acts of courage, honesty, standing up for the truth, do not just evaporate into the ether. They impregnate the atmosphere. And then, in the fullness of time, everything comes to a head. The collapse of communism, the fall of the Berlin Wall, the end of apartheid, freedom for Namibia, and a rash of democracies where before there were dictatorships are not just happy coincidences. They are a tribute to all those such as yourselves who have striven for justice and goodness, even those who might have seemed to have failed. Third, we learned what it meant to be a democracy. And this not so much by watching your parliament at work. I should probably rephrase that, but I would. I believe, in fact, that the greatest monument to your society as being a free society is Speaker's Corner. It was mind-boggling, and I think, I mean, that for you, you are quite blasé about it. But, I mean, you know, when you come from a country where you have Big Brother always watching you, to go to Hyde Park Corner and to see a police officer standing next to the soapbox, not to arrest the person often spouting the most outrageous and subversive sentiments, but to protect this person, thoroughly provocative, from those who might get incensed at what they were saying. Now for me, and I believe for many who came out of the same kind of setting, this was entirely novel. There was an orator, a West Indian, who always drew large audiences. He would say, "There is nothing wrong with England." And then you'd pause dramatically and add, "except for the English." And his audience would be rolling in the aisles. But I recall once when a police officer went across to a motorist who had left his engine idling and asked him to switch it off because someone who was, in fact, particularly provocative was speaking. And the police officer was concerned that the people would not hear what he was saying. Incredible. Well, yes, I mean, here I've got a breath of fresh air. It was a veritable gale, and many of us wanted to enshrine something of the spirit of Hyde Park in our Bill of Rights. And finally, I was impressed by how you did not treat leaders, especially political leaders, with too much deference. Anything but. Those were the days of "that was the week that was," which took the mickey out of everything and everyone. There were hardly any sacred cows left around. In our part of the world, the media, even now, have tended to be kowtowing, and the worst to be lickspittle sycophants. We who have experienced something different, where prime ministers are interviewed aggressively a la Robin Day, have wanted to see a similar ethos develop in our media so that our press could be truly independent and free. As a result of our experiences, we have had the privilege of sharing in our liberation struggle. Our contributions would have been a great deal less significant had we not had the privilege and opportunity of coming overseas out of the claustrophobia of repression and injustice. We are who we are in large measure because of the formation we had overseas. And the contribution of the Overseas Students Trust and Martin has been immeasurable. We hope we can foster relationships between academic institutions, professional bodies in this country with their counterparts in South Africa. We have defeated apartheid, but it has left behind a horrendous legacy in homelessness, unemployment, lack of affordable health care, a massive crisis in education, in working for a more equitable dispensation so that we must not see our government being in office but without power. That the people must experience that there is indeed a qualitative difference between living under repression and living in a democracy. We hope that you will be inspired to resist efforts at becoming insular, at erecting walls to keep out the stranger, to resist the new xenophobia and racism that are abroad. I've spoken of ours as the Rainbow People to underline our diversity, that we should celebrate our differences, for it is these we say we can never, any one of us, be self-sufficient, that we are made for interdependence at personal and national levels. The totally self-sufficient person is subhuman. The totally self-sufficient nation is an aberration. Let us celebrate our diversity in outlook, ethnicity, culture, etc. For we are made for family, for fellowship, for community. We inhabit the global village, and we're sisters and brothers, members of one family, the human family, God's family. Thank you.
Long-standing tradition, and one that I'm very proud to uphold, that, as you said, Archbishop, no one is so eminent in this country that he doesn't get questioned. We've time for a couple of questions, and I hope our guests will understand if I choose first to point at if there are any of those amongst our student body who would like to ask Archbishop a question or two. Any questions?
No.
At the back.
On the subject of respect for leaders, I think Mandela is in great danger of being unduly idolized. Not that he isn't deserving, but just that he is a man like other men as well. And
yeah. I wish there were more men like him. But it is an important point that you make. Let me just say that he has his feet very firmly on the ground. He's a wonderful mixture of regal dignity, an incredible humility. He's very quick at acknowledging what other people have done. And you'll have read his autobiography, and the number of times that he pokes fun at himself, you know, like when he got his first pair of boots and couldn't walk properly, they were squeaking and so forth. You could pick on a number of occasions when he is saying to people, well, if you want me to be an idol, I'd like you to see that I have got feet of clay. Yeah. Yeah.
Again, at the back.
There was some fear before the election that Kim Carter and Pierre Blanchet's people might be put in trouble, and it turned out to be all right then. But is there still a problem, or is the spirit of national reconciliation and everybody? How's that been?
I think, I mean, that there are points of anxiety about what is happening, for instance, in Natal, the rivalry and all sorts of other factors operating there have seen the violence in that part, I mean, KwaZulu-Natal, escalate to about the kind of level that you had before the election, and the fallout between Chief Buthelezi and the king is a very worrying factor. As to the AWB and so forth, what happened to them when they invaded Buputatswana, I think taught them a salutary lesson and lost them very, very considerable support. I mean, they went in there with a lot of bravado, shooting innocent passers-by, and then a very small disciplined police force in Buputatswana routed them. And they went back with their tails between their hind legs, and although it was an awful thing, I mean, that public execution of the two or three guys, it really pricked their bubble very considerably. At the beginning of this year, you probably know, I mean, that there's a new school system, non-racial, and we, many of us, had expected that there was going to be a great deal of trouble. Do you know, in Ventersdorp, the headquarters of the AWB, a school that had been a white school, was handed over to a largely black constituency. And now in Ventersdorp, of all places, you have a school that has a black headmistress with a mixed staff. Now, of course, for you, again, I mean, I think you would say, so what? But I would hope that we don't forget too quickly. We don't suffer from an amnesia about the awfulness of apartheid. We don't want to keep harping on that. But it has to show you the extent of this miracle. You see, in 1989, when we were breaking those laws, beach apartheid, the police said to us, if you don't disperse, we're going to use even live ammunition. Now, live ammunition to shoot and to kill, to maintain beach apartheid. Now, you go into South Africa. If you can find one person who ever supported apartheid, come to me and I'll give you a prize.
Alas, I'm afraid we have to draw this wonderful lecture to a close. Archbishop, we couldn't have chosen anyone better than you to inaugurate this lecture series. And I know I'm speaking not only for all in here, but those in the overflow lecture room that we had to accommodate all the people who wanted to hear you, when I say, from the bottom of our hearts, thank you. We are very grateful.